Jude soon learned to match suspicion with suspicion, and several times verged on discussing doubt with Oscar. That she didn't was a consequence of what she'd seen at the retreat. Doubt had dealt almost casually with the problem of the corpses, dispatching them with the efficiency of one who had covered for his employer in similar circumstances before. Nor had he sought commendation for his labour, at least not within earshot of her. When the relationship between master and servant was so ingrained that a criminal act, the disposal of murdered flesh, was passed over as an unremarkable duty, it was best, she thought, not to come between them. It was she who was the interloper here, the new girl who dreamed she'd belonged to the master forever. She couldn't hope to have Oscar's ear the way Dowd did, and any attempt to sow mistrust might easily rebound upon her. She kept her silence, and things went on their smooth way. Until the day of rain. 2. A trip to the opera had been planned for March 2nd, and she had spent the latter half of the afternoon in leisurely preparation for the evening, idling over her choice of dress and shoes, luxuriating in indecision. Dowd had gone out at lunchtime on urgent business for Oscar, which she knew better than to inquire about. She had been told upon her arrival at the house that any questions as to Oscar's business would not be welcomed, and she'd never challenged that edict. It was not the place of mistresses to do so. But today, with Dowd uncharacteristically flustered as he left, she found herself wondering, as she bathed and dressed, what work Godolphin was about. Was he off in his Ordorex, the city whose streets she assumed gentle now walked with his soulmate the assassin? A mere 2 months before, with the bells of London pealing in the new year, she'd sworn to go to his Ordorex after him. But she'd been distracted from that ambition by the very man whose company she'd sought to take her there. Though her thoughts returned to that mysterious city now, it was without her former appetite. She'd have liked to know if Gentle was safe in those summer streets, and might have enjoyed a description of its seamier quarter, but the fact that she'd once sworn an oath to get there now seemed almost absurd. She had all that she needed here. It wasn't only her curiosity about the other dominions that had been dulled by contentment. Her curiosity about events in her own planet was similarly cool. Though the television burbled constantly in the corner of her bedroom, its presence soporific, she attended to its details scarcely at all, and would not have noticed the mid-afternoon news bulletin, but that an item she caught in passing put her in mind of Charlie. 3 bodies had been found in a shallow grave on Hampstead Heath, the condition of the mutilated corpses implying, the report said, some kind of ritualistic murder. Preliminary investigations further suggested that the deceased had been known to the community of cultists and black magic practitioners in the city, some of whom, in the light of other deaths or disappearances among their number, believed that a vendetta against them was underway. To round the piece off, there was footage of the police searching the bushes and undergrowth of Hampstead Heath, while the rain fell and compounded their misery. The report distressed her for 2 reasons, each related to one of the brothers. The first, that it brought back memories of Charlie sitting in that stuffy little room in the clinic, watching the heath and contemplating suicide. The second, that perhaps this vendetta might endanger Oscar, who was as involved in occult practices as any man alive. She fretted about this for the rest of the afternoon, her concern deepening still further when Oscar failed to return home by 6. She put off dressing for the opera and waited for him downstairs, the front door open, the rain beating the bushes around the step. He returned at 6:40 with Dowd, who had barely stepped through the door before he pronounced that there would be no opera visit tonight. Godolphin contradicted him immediately, much to his chagrin, telling Jude to go and get ready. They'd be leaving in 20 minutes. As she dutifully headed upstairs, she heard Dowd say, "You know McGann wants to see you."
"We can do both," Oscar replied. "Did you put out the black suit?" "No. What have you been doing all day?" "No, don't tell me. Not on an empty stomach."
Oscar looked handsome in black, and she told him so when, 25 minutes later, he came downstairs. In response to the compliment, he smiled and made a small bow.
"And you were never lovelier," he replied. "You know, I don't have a photograph of you. I'd like one for my wallet. We'll have Dowd organise it.
By now Dowd was conspicuous by his absence. Most evenings he would play chauffeur, but tonight he apparently had other business.
We're going to have to miss the first act, Oscar said as they drove. I've got a little errand to run in Highgate, if you'll bear with me.
I don't mind, she said.
He patted her hand.
It won't take long, he said.
Perhaps because he didn't often take the wheel himself, he concentrated hard as he drove, and though the news item she'd seen was still very much in her mind, she was loath to distract him with talk. They made good time, threading their way through the back streets to avoid thoroughfares clogged by rain-slowed traffic and arriving in a veritable cloudburst.
Here we are,
he said, though the windshield was so awash she could barely see 10 yards ahead.
You stay in the warm. I won't be long.
He left her in the car and sprinted across a courtyard towards an anonymous building. Nobody came to the front door. It opened automatically and closed after him. Only when he'd disappeared and the thunderous drumming of the rain on the roof had diminished somewhat did she lean forward to peer out through the watery windshield at the building itself. Despite the rain, she recognized instantly the tower from the dream of Blue Eye. Without conscious instruction, her hand went to the door and opened it, as her breath quickened with denials.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
She got out of the car and turned her face up to the cold rain and to an even colder memory. She'd let this place, and indeed the journey that had brought her here, her mind moving through the streets, touching this woman's grief and that woman's rage, slip into the dubious territory that lay between recollections of the real and those of the dreamed. In essence, she'd allowed herself to believe it had never happened. But here was the very place, to the window, to the brick, and if the exterior were so exactly as she'd seen it, why should she doubt that the interior would be any different? There'd been a labyrinthine cellar, she remembered, lined with shelves piled high with books and manuscripts. There'd been a wall, lovers coupling against it, and behind it, hidden from every sight but hers, a cell in which a bound woman had lain in darkness for a suffering age. She heard the prisoner's scream now in her mind's ear, that howl of madness that had driven her up out of the ground and back through the dark streets to the safety of her own house and head. Was the woman still screaming, she wondered, or had she sunk back into the comatose state from which she'd been so unkindly woken? The thought of her pain brought tears to Jude's eyes, mingling with the rain.
What are you doing?
Oscar had reappeared from the tower and was hurrying across the gravel towards her, his jacket raised and tented over his head.
My dear, you'll freeze to death. Get in the car, please. Please, get in the car.
She did as he suggested, the rain running down her neck.
I'm sorry, she said. I wondered where you'd gone, that was all. Then, I don't know, the place seemed familiar.
It's a place of no importance, he said. You're shivering. Would you prefer we didn't go to the opera?
Would you mind?
Not in the least. Pleasure shouldn't be a trial. You're wet and cold, and we can't have you getting a chill. One sickly individual's enough.
She didn't question this last remark. There was too much else on her mind. She wanted to sob, though whether out of joy or sorrow, she wasn't sure. The dream she'd come to dismiss as fancy was founded in solid fact. And this solid fact beside her, Godolphin, was in turn touched by something momentous. She'd been persuaded by his practiced understatement, the way he talked of travelling to the Dominions as he would of boarding a train, and his expeditions in his Ordericks as a form of tourism as yet unavailable to the great unwashed. But his reductionism was a screen, whether he was aware of the fact or not, a ploy to conceal the greater significance of his business. His ignorance or arrogance might well kill him, she began to suspect. Which thought was the sorrow in her. And the joy? That she might save him, and he learn to love her out of gratitude. Back at the house, they both changed out of their formal attire. When she emerged from her room on the top floor, she found him on the stairs, waiting for her.
I wonder. Perhaps we should talk?
They went downstairs into the tasteful clutter of the lounge. The rain beat against the window. He drew the curtains and poured them brandies to fortify them against the cold. Then he sat down opposite her.
We have a problem, you and I.
We do?
There's so much we have to say to each other. At least, here am I presuming it's reciprocal, but for myself, certainly. Certainly I've got a good deal I want to say, and I'm damned if I know where to begin. I'm aware that I owe you explanations about what you saw at the estate, about Dowd and the Voiders, about what I did to Charlie. The list goes on. And I've tried, really I have, to find some way to make it all clear to you. But the truth is, I'm not sure of the truth myself. Memory plays such tricks.
She made a murmur of agreement.
Especially when you're dealing with places and people who seem to belong half in your dreams. Or in your nightmares.
He drained his glass and reached for the bottle he'd set on the table beside him.
I don't like Dowd, she said suddenly. And I don't trust him.
He looked up from refilling his glass.
That's perceptive, he said. You want some more brandy?
She proffered her glass, and he poured her an ample measure.
I agree with you, he said. He's a dangerous creature for a number of reasons.
Can't you get rid of him?
He knows too much, I'm afraid. He'd be more dangerous out of my employ than in it.
Has he got something to do with these murders? Just today I saw the news.
He waved her inquiry away.
You don't need to know about any of that, my dear, he said.
But if you're at risk...
I'm not. I'm not. At least be reassured about that.
So you know all about it?
Yes, he said heavily. I know a little something. And so does Dowd. In fact, he knows more about this whole situation than you and I put together.
She wondered about this. Did Dowd know about the prisoner behind the wall, for instance? Or was that a secret she had entirely to herself? If so, perhaps she'd be wise to keep it that way. When so many players in this game had information she lacked, sharing anything, even with Oscar, might weaken her position. Perhaps threaten her life. Some part of her nature not susceptible to the blandishments of luxury or the need for love was lodged behind that wall with the woman she'd woken. She would leave it there, safe in the darkness. The rest, anything else she knew, she'd share.
You're not the only one who crosses over, she said. A friend of mine went.
Really?
He said.
Who?
His name's Gentle. Actually, his real name's Zacharias. John Fury Zacharias. Charlie knew him a little.
Charlie.
Oscar shook his head.
Poor Charlie.
Then he said,
Tell me about Gentle.
It's complicated, she said. When I left Charlie, he got very vengeful. He hired somebody to kill me.
She went on to tell Oscar about the murder attempt in New York and Gentle's later intervention, then about the events of New Year's Eve. As she related this, she had the distinct impression that at least some of what she was telling him he already knew, a suspicion confirmed when she'd finished her description of Gentle's removal from this dominion.
The mischief took him?
He said.
My God, that's a risk.
What's a mischief? She asked.
A very rare creature indeed. One would be born into the Urhotemic tribe once in a generation. They're reputedly extraordinary lovers. As I understand it, they have no sexual identity, except as a function of their partner's desire.
That sounds like Gentle's idea of paradise.
As long as you know what you want, Oscar said. If you don't, I dare say it could get very confusing.
She laughed.
He knows what he wants, believe me.
You speak from experience?
Bitter experience.
He may have bitten off more than he can chew, so to speak, keeping the company of a mischief. My friend in his Orderex, Peckable, had a mistress for a while who'd been a madam. She'd had a very plush establishment in Potashokwa, and she and I got on famously. She kept telling me I should become a white slaver and bring her girls from the Fifth, so she could start a new business in his Orderex. She reckoned we'd have made a fortune. We never did it, of course, but we both enjoyed talking about things venereal. It's a pity that word's so tainted, isn't it? You say venereal, and people immediately think of disease instead of Venus.
He paused, seeming to have lost his way, then said,
"Anyway, she told me once that she'd employed a mistiff for a while in her bordello, and it caused her no end of problems. She'd almost had to close her place because of the reputation she got. You'd think a creature like that would make the ultimate whore, wouldn't you? But apparently a lot of customers just didn't want to see their desires made flesh."
He watched her as he spoke, a smile playing around his lips.
"I can't imagine why."
"Maybe they were afraid of what they were."
"You'd consider that foolish, I assume."
"Yes, of course.
What you are, you are." "That's a hard philosophy to live up to."
"No harder than running away."
"Oh, I don't know. I've thought about running away quite a lot of late. Disappearing forever."
"Really?"
she said, trying to stifle any show of agitation.
"Why?"
"Too many birds coming home to roost."
"But you're staying?"
"I vacillate. England's so pleasant in the spring, and I'd miss the cricket in the summer months."
"They play cricket everywhere, don't they?"
"Not in Isorderex, they don't."
"You'd go there forever?"
"Why not? Nobody would find me, because nobody would ever guess where I'd gone."
"I'd know."
"Then maybe I'd have to take you with me,"
he said tentatively, almost as though he were making the proposal in all seriousness and was afraid of being refused.
"Could you bear that thought,"
he said,
"of leaving the Fifth, I mean?"
"I could bear it."
He paused. Then,
"I think it's about time I showed you some of my treasures," he said, rising from his chair. "Come on."
She'd known from oblique remarks of Dowd's that the locked room on the second floor contained some kind of collection, but its nature, when he finally unlocked the door and ushered her in, astonished her.
"All this was collected in the Dominions," Oscar explained, "and brought back by hand."
He escorted her around the room, giving her a capsule summary of what some of the stranger objects were, and bringing from hiding tiny items she might otherwise have overlooked. Into the former category, among others, went the Boston Bowl and Gord Mabelham's Encyclopedia of Heavenly Signs. Into the latter, a bracelet of beetles caught by the killing jar in their daisy chain coupling. 14 generations, he explained, male entering female, and female in turn devouring the male in front, the circle joined by the youngest female and the oldest male, who, by dint of the latter's suicidal acrobatics, were face to face. She had many questions, of course, and he was pleased to play the teacher, but there were several inquiries he had no answers to. Like the empire looters from whom he was descended, he assembled the collection with commitment, taste, and ignorance in equal measure. Yet when he spoke of the artifacts, even those whose function he had no clue to, there was a touching fervour in his tone, familiar as he was with the tiniest detail of the tiniest piece.
"You gave some objects to Charlie, didn't you?" she said.
"Once in a while. Did you see them?"
"Yes, indeed," she said,
the brandy tempting her tongue to confess the dream of the blue eye, her brain resisting it.
"If things had been different," Oscar said, "Charlie might have been the one wandering the Dominions. I owe him a glimpse."
"A piece of the miracle," she quoted.
"That's right. But I'm sure he felt ambivalent about them."
"That was Charlie."
"True, true. He was too English for his own good. He never had the courage of his feelings, except where you were concerned. And who could blame him?"
She looked up from the trinket she was studying to find that she, too, was a subject of study, the look on his face unequivocal.
"It's a family problem," he said, "when it comes to matters of the heart."
This confession made, a look of discomfort crossed his face and his hand went to his ribs.
"I'll leave you to look around, if you like," he said. "There's nothing in here that's really volatile."
"Thank you."
"Will you lock up after yourself?"
"Of course."
She watched him go, unable to think of anything to detain him, but feeling forsaken once he'd gone. She heard him go to his bedroom, which was down the hall on the same floor, and close the door behind him. Then she turned her attention back to the treasures on the shelves. It wouldn't stay there, however. She wanted to touch, and be touched by, something warmer than these relics. After a few moments of hesitation, she left them in the dark, locking the door behind her. She would take the key back to him, she'd decided. If his words of admiration were not simple flattery, if he had bed on his mind, she'd know it soon enough. And if he rejected her, at least there'd be an end to this trial by doubt. She knocked on the bedroom door. There was no reply. There was light seeping from under the door, however, so she knocked again and then turned the handle and, saying his name softly, entered. The lamp beside the bed was burning, illuminating an ancestral portrait that hung over it. Through its gilded window, a severe and sallow individual gazed down on the empty sheets. Hearing the sound of running water from the adjacent bathroom, Jude crossed the bedroom, taking in a dozen details of this, his most private chamber, as she did so. The plushness of the pillows and the linen, the spirit decanter and glass beside the bed, the cigarettes and ashtray on a small heap of well-thumbed paperbacks. Without declaring herself, she pushed the door open. Oscar was sitting on the edge of the bath in his undershorts, dabbing a washcloth to a partially healed wound in his side. Reddened water ran over the furry swell of his belly. Hearing her, he looked up. There was pain on his face. She didn't attempt to offer an excuse for being there, nor did he request one. He simply said,
"Charlie did it."
"You should see a doctor."
"I don't trust doctors. Besides, it's getting better."
He tossed the washcloth into the sink.
"Do you make a habit of walking into bathrooms unannounced?" he said. "You could have walked in on something even less."
"Venereal," she said.
"Don't mock me," he replied. "I'm a crude seducer, I know. It comes from years of buying company."
"Would you be more comfortable buying me?" she said.
"My God," he replied, his look appalled. "What do you take me for?"
"A lover," she said plainly. "My lover?"
"I wonder if you know what you're saying."
"What I don't know, I'll learn," she said. "I've been hiding from myself, Oscar, putting everything out of my head so I wouldn't feel anything. But I feel a lot, and I want you to know that."
"I know," he said. "More than you can understand, I know. And it makes me afraid, Judith."
"There's nothing to be afraid of," she said, astonished that it was she who was mouthing these words of reassurance when he was the elder and presumably the stronger, the wiser.
She reached out and put her palm flat against his massive chest. He bent forward to kiss her, his mouth closed until he met hers and found it open. One hand went around her back, the other to her breast, her murmur of pleasure smeared between their mouths. His touch moved down over her stomach, past her groin, to hoist up her skirt and retrace its steps. His fingers found her sopping. She'd been wet since first stepping into the treasure room, and he slid his whole hand down into the hot pouch of her underwear, pressing the heel of his palm against the top of her sex, while his long middle digit sought out her fundament, gently catching its flukes with his nail.
"Bed," she said.
He didn't let her go. They made an ungainly exit from the bathroom, with him guiding her backwards until she felt the edge of the bed behind her thighs. There she sat down, taking hold of the waistband of his blood-stained shorts and easing them down while she kissed his belly. Suddenly bashful, he reached to stop her, but she pulled them down until his penis appeared. It was a curiosity. Only a little engorged, it had been deprived of its foreskin, which made its outlandishly bulbous carmine head look even more inflamed than the wound in its wielder's side. The stem was very considerably thinner and paler, its length knotted with veins bearing blood to its crown. If it was this disproportion that embarrassed him, he had no need, and to prove her pleasure she put her lips against the head. His objecting hand was no longer in evidence. She heard him make a little moan above and looked up to see him staring down at her with something very like awe on his face. Sliding her fingers beneath testicles and stem, she raised the curiosity to her mouth and took it inside. Then she dropped both hands to her blouse and began to unbutton. But he'd no sooner started to harden in her mouth than he murmured a denial, withdrew his member, and stepped back from her, pulling up his underwear.
"Why are you doing this?"
he said.
I'm enjoying it."
He was genuinely agitated, she saw, shaking his head, covering the bulge in his underwear in a new fit of bashfulness.
"For whose sake?" he said. "You don't have to, you know."
"I know."
"I wonder,"
he said, genuine puzzlement in his voice.
"I don't want to use you."
"I wouldn't let you."
"Maybe you wouldn't know."
This remark inflamed her. A rage rose such as she'd not felt in a long while. She stood up.
"I know what I want," she said, "but I'm not about to beg for it."
"That's not what I'm saying."
"What are you saying?"
"That I want you too."
"So do something about it," she said.
He seemed to find her fury freshly arousing and stepped towards her again, saying her name in a voice almost pained with feeling.
"I'd like to undress you," he said. "Would you mind?"
"No."
"I don't want you to do anything."
"Then I won't."
"Except lie down."
She did so. He turned off the bathroom light, then came to the edge of the bed and looked down at her. His bulk was emphasized by the light from the lamp, which threw his shadow up to the ceiling. Quantity had never seemed an arousing quality hitherto, but in him she found it intensely attractive, evidence as it was of his excesses and his appetites. Here was a man who would not be contained by one world, one set of experiences, but who was kneeling now like a slave in front of her, his expression that of one obsessed. With consummate tenderness, he began to undress her. She'd known fetishists before, men to whom she was not an individual but a hook upon which some particular item was hung for worship. If there was any such particular in this man's head, it was the body he now began to uncover, proceeding to do so in an order and manner that made some fevered sense to him. First he slipped off her underpants. Then he finished unbuttoning her blouse, without removing it. Next he teased her breasts from her bra, so that they were available to his toying, but then didn't play there, but went to her shoes, removing them and setting them beside the bed, before hoisting up her skirt so as to have a view of her sex. Here his eyes lingered, his fingers advancing up her thigh to the crease of her groin, then retreating. Not once did he look at her face. She looked at his, however, enjoying the zeal and veneration there. Finally he rewarded his own diligence with kisses, first on her lower legs, moving up towards her knees, then her stomach and her breasts, and finally returning to her thighs and up into the place he'd forbidden them both till now. She was ready for pleasure, and he supplied it, his huge hand caressing her breasts as he tongued her. She closed her eyes as he unfolded her, alive to every drop of moisture on her labia and legs. When he rose from this to finish undressing her, skirt first, then blouse and bra, her face was hot and her breath fast. He tossed the clothes onto the floor and stood up again, taking her knees and pushing them up and back, spreading her for his delectation and holding her there, prettily exposed.
"Finger yourself,"
he said, not letting her go. She put her hands between her legs and made a show for him. He'd slickened her well, but her fingers went deeper than his tongue, readying herself for the curiosity. He gorged on the sight, meanwhile, glancing up to her face several times, then returning to the spectacle below. All trace of his previous hesitation had gone. He encouraged her with his admiration, calling her a host of sweet names, his tented underwear proof, as if she needed it, of his arousal. She started to push her hips up from the bed to meet her fingers, and he took firmer grip of her knees as she moved, opening her wider still. Lifting his right hand to his mouth, he licked his middle finger and put it down against her pucker of her other hole, rubbing it gently.
"Will you suck me now?"
he asked her.
"Just a little."
"Show me it," she said.
He stepped away from her and took off his underwear. The curiosity was now fully risen and florid. She sat up and put it back, between her lips, one hand holding it by its pulsing root while the other continued its dalliance with her own sex. She'd never been good at guessing the point at which the milk boiled over, so she took it from the heat of her mouth to cool him a little, glancing up at him as she did so. Either the extraction or her glance set him off, however.
"Damn,"
he said.
"Damn!
and started to step back from her, his hand going down to his groin to take the curiosity in a stranglehold. It seemed he might have succeeded, as two desultory dribbles ran from its head. Then his testicles unleashed their flood, and it came forth in uncommon abundance. He moaned as it came, as much in self-admonishment as pleasure, she thought, that assumption confirmed when he'd emptied his sack upon the floor.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry."
"There's no need," she said,
standing up and putting her lips to his. He continued to murmur his apologies, however.
"I haven't done that in a long time," he said. "So adolescent."
She kept her silence, knowing anything she said would only begin a further round of self-reproach. He slipped away into the bathroom to find a towel. When he returned, she was picking up her clothes.
"Are you going?"
he said.
"Only to my room."
"Do you have to?"
he said.
"I know that wasn't much of a performance, but the bed's big enough for us both. And I don't snore."
"The bed's enormous."
"So, would you stay?"
he said.
"I'd like to."
He made a charming smile.
"I'm honored,"
he said.
"Will you excuse me a moment?"
He switched the bathroom light back on and disappeared inside, closing the door, leaving her to lie back on the bed and wonder at this whole turn of events. Its very oddness seemed appropriate. After all, this whole journey had begun with an act of misplaced love. Love become murder. Now a new dislocation. Here she was, lying in the bed of a man with a body far from beautiful, whose bulk she longed to have upon her, whose hands were capable of fratricide, but aroused her like none she'd ever known, who'd walked more worlds than an opium poet, but couldn't speak love without stumbling, who was a titan, and yet afraid. She made a nest among his duck-down pillows and waited there for him to come back and tell her a story of love. He reappeared after a long while and slipped beneath the sheets beside her. True to her imaginings, he said he loved her at last, but only once he'd turned the light out, and his eyes were not available for study. When she slept, it was deeply, and when she woke again, it was like sleeping, dark and pleasurable, the former because the drapes were still drawn, and between their cracks she could see that the sky was still benighted, the latter because Oscar was behind her and inside. One of his hands was upon her breast, the other lifting her leg so that he could ease his upward stroke. He had entered her with skill and discretion, she realized. Not only had he not stirred her until he was embedded, but he'd chosen the virgin passage, which, had he suggested it while she was awake, she'd have attempted to coax him from, fearing the discomfort. In truth, there was none, though the sensation was quite unlike anything she'd felt before. He kissed her neck and shoulder blade, light kisses as though he was unaware of her wakefulness. She made it known with a sigh. His stroke slowed and stopped, but she pressed her buttocks back to meet his thrust, satisfying his curiosity as to the limit of its access, which was to say, none. She was happy to accept him entirely, trapping his hand against her breast to press it to rougher service while putting her own at the connecting place. He dutifully slipped on a condom before entering her, which, together with the fact that he'd already poured forth once tonight, made him a near-perfect lover, slow and certain. She didn't use the dark to reconfigure him. The man pressing his face into her hair and biting at her shoulder wasn't, like the mischief he'd described, a reflection of imagined ideals. It was Oscar Godolphin, paunch, curiosity and all. What she did reconfigure was herself, so that she became in her mind's eye a glyph of sensation, a line dividing from the coil of her pierced core up through her belly to the points of her breasts, then intersecting again at her nape, crossing and becoming woven spirals beneath the hood of her skull. Her imagination added a further refinement, inscribing a circle around this figure which burned in the darkness behind her lips like a vision. Her rapture was perfected then, being an abstraction in his arms yet pleasured like flesh. There was no greater luxury. He asked if they might move, saying only,
"The wound,"
by way of explanation. She went on to her hands and knees, he slipping from her for a tormenting moment while she did so, then putting the curiosity back to work. His rhythm instantly became more urgent, his fingers in her sex, his voice in her head, both expressing ecstasy. The glyph brightened in her mind's eye, fiery from end to end. She yelled out to him, first only yes and yes, then plainer demands, inflaming him to new invention. The glyph became blinding, burning away all thought of where she was, or what, all memory of conjunctions past, subsumed in this perpetuity. She was not even aware that he'd spent himself until she felt him withdrawing, and then she reached behind her to keep him inside a while longer. He obliged. She enjoyed the sensation of his softening inside her, and even finally his exiting, the tender muscle yielding its prisoner reluctantly. Then he rolled over onto the bed beside her and reached for the light. It was dim enough not to sting, but still too bright, and she was about to protest when she saw that he was putting his fingers to his injured side. Their congress had unknitted the wound. Blood was running from it in two directions, down towards the curiosity still nestled in the condom, and down his side to the sheet.
"It's all right," he said as she made to get up. "It looks worse than it is."
"It still needs something to staunch it," she said.
"That's good Godolphin blood," he said,
wincing and grinning at the same moment. His gaze went from her face to the portrait above the bed.
"It's always flowed freely," he said.
"He doesn't look as though he approved of us," she said.
"On the contrary," Oscar replied. "I know for a fact he'd adore you. Joshua understood devotion."
She looked at the wound again. Blood was seeping between his fingers.
"Won't you let me cover that up?" she said. "It makes me queasy."
"For you, anything."
"Have you got any dressing?"
"Dowd's probably got some, but I don't want him knowing about us. At least not yet. Let's keep it our secret."
"You, me, and Joshua," she said.
"Even Joshua doesn't know what we got up to,"
Oscar said, without a trace of irony audible in his voice.
"Why do you think I turned the light out?"
In lieu of fresh dressing, she went through to the bathroom to find a towel. While she was doing so, he spoke to her through the open door.
"I meant what I said, by the way,"
he told her.
"About what?"
"That I'll do anything for you. At least, anything that's in my power to do or give. I want you to stay with me, Judith. I'm no Adonis. I know that. But I learned a lot from Joshua. About devotion, I mean."
She emerged with the towel to be greeted by the same offer.
"Anything you want."
"That's very generous."
"The pleasure's in the giving," he said.
"I think you know what I'd like most."
He shook his head.
"I'm no good at guessing games. Only cricket. Just tell me."
She sat down on the edge of the bed and gently tugged his hand from the wound in his side, wiping the blood from between his fingers.
"Say it,"
he told her.
"Very well," she said.
"I want you to take me out of this dominion. I want you to show me Isorderex." Chapter 25 1 22 days after emerging from the icy wastes of the Jokalelau into the balmier climes of the Third Dominion, days which had seen Pi and Gentle's fortunes rise dramatically as they journeyed through the Third's diverse territories, the wanderers were standing on a station platform outside the tiny town of Maike, waiting for the train that once a week came through on its way from the city of Yamandas in the northeast to Limbi, half a day's journey to the south. They were eager to be departing. Of all the towns and villages they'd visited in the past 3 weeks, Maike had been the least welcoming. It had its reasons. It was a community under siege from the Dominion's two sons, the rains which brought the region its crops having failed to materialize for 6 consecutive years. Terraces and fields that should have been bright with shoots were virtually dust bowls. Stocks, hoarded against this eventuality, critically depleted. Famine was imminent, and the village was in no mood to entertain strangers. The previous night the entire populace had been out in the drab streets praying aloud, these imprecations led by their spiritual leaders, who had about them the air of men whose invention was nearing its end. The noise, so unmusical, Gentle had observed that it would irritate the most sympathetic of deities, had gone on until first light, making sleep impossible. As a consequence, exchanges between Pi and Gentle were somewhat tense this morning. They were not the only travellers waiting for the train. A farmer from Maike had brought a herd of sheep onto the platform, some of them so emaciated it was a wonder they could stand, and the flock had brought with them clouds of the local pest, an insect called a zazai, that had the wingspan of a dragonfly and a body as fat and furred as a bee. It fed on sheep ticks, unless it could find something more tempting. Gentle's blood fell into this latter category, and the lazy whine of the zazai was never far from his ears as he waited in the midday heat. Their one informant in Maike, a woman called Hairstone Banty, had predicted that the train would be on time. But it was already well overdue, which didn't augur well for the 100 other pieces of advice she'd offered them the night before. Swatting Zazai to left and right, Gentle emerged from the shade of the platform building to peer down the track. It ran without crook or bend to its vanishing point, empty every mile of the way. On the rails a few yards from where he stood, rats, a gangrenous variety called graviolans, toed and froed, gathering dead grasses for the nests they were constructing between the rails and the gravel the rails were set upon. Their industry only served to irritate Gentle further.
"We're stuck here forever," he said to Pi, who was squatting on the platform making marks on the stone with a sharp pebble. "This is Hairstone's revenge on a couple of Hoopria."
He'd heard this term whispered in their presence countless times. It meant anything from exotic stranger to repugnant leper, depending on the facial expression of the speaker. The people of Maike were keen face-pullers, and when they'd used the word in Gentle's company, there was little doubt which end of the scale of affections they had in mind.
"It'll come," said Pi. "We're not the only ones waiting."
Two more groups of travellers had appeared on the platform in the last few minutes. A family of Maikeaks, three generations represented, who had lugged everything they owned down to the station, and three women in voluminous robes, their heads shaved and plastered with white mud, nuns of the goetic Kisaranki, an order as despised in Maike as any well-fed Hooprio. Gentle took some comfort from the appearance of these fellow travellers, but the track was still empty. The graviolans, who would surely be the first to sense any disturbance in the rails, going about their nest building unperturbed. He wearied of watching them very quickly and turned his attention to Pi's scrawlings.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm trying to work out how long we've been here."
"2 days in Maike, a day and a half on the road from Attaboy."
"No, no," said the mischief. "I'm trying to work it out in Earth days, right from the first arriving in the Dominions."
"We tried that in the mountains and we didn't get anywhere."
"That's because our brains were frozen stiff.
So have you done it?"
"Give me a little time."
"Time we've got," Gentle said, returning his gaze to the antics of graviolans. "These little buggers'll have grandchildren by the time the damn train arrives."
The mischief went on with its calculations, leaving Gentle to wander back into the comparative comfort of the waiting room, which, to judge by the sheep droppings on the floor, had been used to pen entire flocks in the recent past. The Zazai followed him, buzzing around his brow. He pulled from his ill-fitting jacket, bought with money he and Pi had won gambling in Attaboy, a dog-eared copy of Fanny Hill, the only volume in English, besides Pilgrim's Progress, which he'd been able to purchase, and used it to flail at the insects, then gave up. They'd tire of him eventually, or else he'd become immune to their attacks. Whichever, he didn't care. He leaned against the graffiti-covered wall and yawned. He was bored. Of all things, bored. If, when they'd first arrived in Vanayef, Pi had suggested that a few weeks later the wonders of the reconciled dominions would have become tedious, Gentle would have laughed the thought off as nonsense. With a gold-green sky above and the spires of Parashokwa gleaming in the distance, the scope for adventure had seemed endless. But by the time he'd reached Beatrix, the fond memories of which had not been entirely erased by images of its ruin, he was travelling like any man in a foreign land, prepared for occasional revelations, but persuaded that the nature of conscious, curious bipeds was a constant under any heaven. They'd seen a great deal in the last few days, to be sure, but nothing he might not have imagined had he not stayed at home and got seriously drunk. Yes, there had been glorious sights, but there had also been hours of discomfort, boredom and banality. On their way to Maikeh, for instance, they'd been exhorted to stay in some nameless hamlet to witness the community's festival, the annual donkey drowning. The origins of this ritual were, they were told, shrouded in fabulous mystery. They declined, Gentle remarking that this surely marked the nadir of their journey, and travelled on in the back of a wagon whose driver informed them that the vehicle had served his family for 6 generations as a dung carrier. He then proceeded to explain at great length the life cycle of his family's ancient foe, the Pensanu, or shite rooster, a beast that with one turd could render an entire wagon load of dung inedible. They didn't press the man as to who in the region dined thusly, but they peered closely at their plates for many days following. As he sat, rolling the hard pellets of sheep dung under his heel, Gentle turned his thoughts to the one high point in their journey across the third. That was the town of Efatoy, which Gentle had rechristened Attaboy. It wasn't that large, the size of Amsterdam, perhaps, and with that city's charm, but it was a gambler's paradise, drawing souls addicted to chance from across the Dominion. Here every game in the Imagica could be played. If your credit wasn't good in the casinos or the cockpits, you could always find a desperate man somewhere who'd bet on the colour of your next piss, if it was the only game on offer. Working together with what was surely telepathic efficiency, Gentle and the Mistiff had made a small fortune in the city, in 8 currencies, no less, enough to keep them in clothes, food and train tickets until they reached Isordrex. It wasn't profit that had almost seduced Gentle into setting up house there, however. It was a local delicacy. A cake of strudel pastry and the honey-softened seeds of a marriage between peach and pomegranate, which he ate before they gambled to give him vim, then while they gambled to calm his nerves, and then again in celebration when they'd won. It was only when Pye assured him that the confection would be available elsewhere, and if it wasn't they now had sufficient funds to hire their own pastry chef to make it, the Gentle was persuaded to depart. Limby called.
"We have to move on," the Mistiff had said. "Skopeek will be waiting."
"You make it sound like he's expecting us."
"I'm always expected," Pye said.
"How long since you were in Limby?"
"At least 230 years.
"Then he'll be dead."
"Not Skopeek," Pye said. "It's important you see him, Gentle, especially now, with so many changes in the air."
"If that's what you want to do, then we'll do it," Gentle had replied. "How far is Limby?"
"A day's journey, if we take the train."
That had been the first mention Gentle had heard of the iron road that joined the city of Yamandas and Limby, the city of furnaces and the city of temples.
"You're like Limby," Pye had said. "It's a place of meditation."
Rested and funded, they'd left Attaboy the following morning, travelling along the river Fefe for a day, then via Happy and Omutajiv into the province called the Chedloched, the flowering place, now bloomless, and finally to Maikeh, caught in the twin pincers of poverty and Puritanism. On the platform outside, Gentle heard Pye say,
"Good."
He raised himself from the comfort of the wall and stepped out into the sunshine again.
"The train?"
he said.
"No, the calculations. I've finished them."
The Mistiff stared down at the marks on the platform at his feet.
"This is only an approximation, of course, but I think it's sound within a day or two. 3 at the most."
"So what day is it?"
"Take a guess."
"March. The 10th.
"Way off," said Pye. "By these calculations, and remember this is only an approximation, it's the 17th of May."
"Impossible."
"It's true.
Spring's almost over."
"Are you wishing you were back there?"
Pye asked. Gentle chewed on this for a while, then said,
"Not particularly. I just wish the fucking trains ran on time."
He wandered to the edge of the platform and stared down the line.
"There's no sign," Pye said. "We'd be quicker going by Doikai."
"You keep doing that."
"Doing what?"
"Saying what's on the tip of my tongue. Are you reading my mind?"
"No,"
said the Mistiff, rubbing out its calculation with its soul.
"So how did we win all that in Attaboy?"
"You don't need teaching," Pye replied.
"Don't tell me it comes naturally," Gentle said.
"I've got through my entire life without winning a thing, and suddenly, when you're with me, I can do no wrong. That's no coincidence. Tell me the truth.
That is the truth. You don't need teaching. Reminding, maybe.
Pye gave a little smile.
And that's another thing, Gentle said, snatching at one of the Zazai as he spoke.
Much to his surprise, he actually caught it. He opened his palm. He'd cracked its casing, and the blue mush of its innards was oozing out, but it was still alive. Disgusted, he flicked his wrist, depositing the body on the platform at his feet. He didn't scrutinize the remains, but pulled up a fistful of the sickly grass that sprouted between the slabs of the platform, and set about scrubbing his palm with it.
"What were we talking about?" he said.
Pye didn't reply.
"Oh, yes. Things I'd forgotten."
He looked down at his clean hand.
"Pneuma," he said. "Why would I ever forget having a power like the pneuma? Either because it wasn't important to you any longer, which is doubtful, or you forgot because you wanted to forget."
There was an oddness in the way the mystif pronounced its reply which grated on Gentle's ear, but he pursued the argument anyway.
"Why would I want to forget?" he said.
Pye looked back along the line. The distance was obscured by dust, but there were glimpses through it of a clear sky.
"Well," said Gentle.
"Maybe because remembering hurts too much," it said, without looking around.
The words were even uglier to Gentle's ear than the reply that had preceded it. He caught the sense, but only with difficulty.
"Stop this," he said.
"Stop what?"
"Talking in that damn fool way. It turns my gut."
"I'm not doing anything,"
the mystif said, its voice still distorted, but now more subtly.
"Trust me, I'm doing nothing."
"So tell me about the pneuma," Gentle said. "I want to know how I came by a power like that."
Pye started to reply, but this time the words were so badly disfigured and the sound itself so ugly, it was like a fist in Gentle's stomach, stirring the stew there.
"Jesus!"
he said, rubbing his belly in a vain attempt to soothe the churning.
"Whatever you're playing at..."
"It's not me," Pye protested. "It's you. You don't want to hear what I'm saying."
"Yes, I do,"
Gentle said, wiping beads of chilly sweat from around his mouth.
"I want answers. I want straight answers."
Grimly, Pye started to speak again. But immediately the waves of nausea climbed Gentle's gut with fresh zeal. The pain in his belly was sufficient to bend him double, but he was damned if the mystif was going to keep anything from him. It was a matter of principle now. He studied Pye's lips through narrowed eyes, but after a few words the mystif stopped speaking.
"Tell me,"
Gentle said, determined to have Pye obey him even if he could make no sense of the words.
"What have I done that I want to forget so badly? Tell me!"
Its face all reluctance, the mystif once again opened its mouth. The words, when they came, were so hopelessly corrupted, Gentle could barely grasp a fraction of their sense. Something about power. Something about death. Point proved he waved the source of this excremental din away and turned his eyes in search of a sight to calm his belly. But the scene around him was a convention of little horrors. A graviolent making its wretched nest beneath the rails. The perspective of the track snatching his eye into the dust, the dead Zazai at his feet, its egg sac split, spattering its unborn onto the stone. This last image, vile as it was, brought food to mind. The harbour meal in his Ordorex, fish within fish within fish, the littlest filled with eggs. The thought defeated him. He tottered to the edge of the platform and vomited onto the rails, his gut convulsing. He didn't have that much in his belly, but the heaves went on and on until his abdomen ached and tears of pain ran from his eyes. At last he stepped back from the platform edge, shuddering. The smell of his stomach was still in his nostrils, but the spasms were steadily diminishing. From the corner of his eye he saw Pye approach.
"Don't come near me,"
he said.
"I don't want you touching me."
He turned his back on the vomit and its cause and retired to the shade of the waiting room, sitting down on the hard wood bench, putting his head against the wall and closing his eyes. As the pain eased and finally disappeared, his thoughts turned to the purpose behind Pye's assault. He'd quizzed the Mistiff several times over the past 4.5 months about the problem of power, how it was come by, and, more particularly, how he, Gentle, had come to possess it. Pye's replies had been oblique in the extreme, but Gentle hadn't felt any great urge to get to the bottom of the question. Perhaps subconsciously he hadn't really wanted to know. Classically, such gifts had consequences, and he was enjoying his role as getter and wielder of power too much to want it spoiled with talk of hubris. He'd been content to be fobbed off with hints and equivocation, and he might have continued to be content if he hadn't been irritated by the Zazai and the lateness of the Limby train, bored and ready for an argument. But that was only half the issue. He'd pressed the Mistiff, certainly, but he'd scarcely goaded it. The attack seemed out of all proportion to the offence. He'd asked an innocent question, and been turned inside out for doing so. So much for all that loving talk in the mountains.
Gentle? Fuck you!
The train, Gentle.
What about it?
It's coming.
He opened his eyes. The Mistiff was standing in the doorway looking forlorn.
I'm sorry that had to happen, it said.
It didn't have to, Gentle said. You made it happen.
Truly I didn't.
What was it then? Something I ate?
No, but there are some questions.
That make me sick.
That have answers you don't want to hear.
What do you take me for?
Gentle said, his tone all quiet contempt.
I ask a question. You fill my head with so much shit for an answer that I throw up. And then it's my fault for asking in the first place. What kind of fucked-up logic is that?
The Mistiff raised its hands in mock surrender.
I'm not going to argue, it said.
Damn right,
Gentle replied. Any further exchange would have been impractical anyway, with the sound of the train's approach steadily getting louder, and its arrival being greeted by cheers and clapping from an audience that had gathered on the platform. Still feeling delicate when he stood, Gentle followed Pye out into the crowd. It seemed half the inhabitants of Maikei had come down to the station. Most, he assumed, were sightseers rather than potential travellers, the train a distraction from hunger and unanswered prayers. There were some families here who planned to board, however, pressing through the crowd with their luggage. What privations they'd endured to purchase their escape from Maikei could only be imagined. There was much sobbing as they embraced those they were leaving behind, most of whom were old folk, who, to judge by their grief, did not expect to see their children and grandchildren again. The journey to Limby, which for Gentle and Pye was little more than a jaunt, was for them a departure into memory. That said, there could be few more spectacular means of departure in the Imagicka than the massive locomotive which was only now emerging from a cloud of evaporating steam. Whoever had made blueprints for this roaring, glistening machine knew its Earth counterpart, the kind of locomotives outdated in the West but still serving in China and India, very well. Their imitation was not so slavish as to suppress a certain decorative joie de vivre. It had been painted so gaudily it looked like the male of the species in search of a mate, but beneath the daubings was a machine that might have steamed into King's Cross or Marylebone in the years following the Great War. It drew 6 carriages and as many freight vehicles again, 2 of the latter being loaded with a flock of sheep. Pye had already been down the line of carriages and was now coming back towards Gentle.
"The second. It's fuller down the other end."
They got in. The interiors had once been lush, but usage had taken its toll. Most of the seats had been stripped of both padding and headrests, and some were missing backs entirely. The floor was dusty, and the walls, which had once been decorated in the same riot as the engine, were in dire need of a fresh coat of paint. There were only 2 other occupants, both male, both grotesquely fat, and both wearing frock coats from which elaborately bound limbs emerged, lending them the look of clerics who'd escaped from an accident ward. Their features were minuscule, crowded in the centre of each face as if clinging together for fear of drowning in fat. Both were eating nuts, cracking them in their pudgy fists and dropping little rains of pulverized shell on the floor between them.
"Brothers of the Boulevard," Pye remarked,
as Gentle took a seat as far from the nutcrackers as possible. Pye sat across the aisle from him, the bag containing what few belongings they'd accrued to date, alongside. There was then a long delay, while recalcitrant animals were beaten and cajoled into boarding for what they perhaps knew was a ride to the slaughterhouse, and those on the platform made their final farewells. It wasn't just the vows and tears that came in through the windows. So did the stench of the animals and the inevitable zazai. Though with the brothers and their meal to attract them, the insects were uninterested in Gentle's flesh. Wearied by the hours of waiting and wrung out by his nausea, Gentle dozed, and finally fell into so deep a sleep that the train's long-delayed departure didn't stir him, and when he woke, 2 hours of their journey had already passed. Very little had changed outside the window. Here were the same expanses of grey-brown earth that had stretched around Maike, clusters of dwellings built from mud in times of water and barely distinguishable from the ground they stood upon, dotted here and there. Occasionally they would pass a plot of land, either blessed with a spring or better irrigated than the ground around it, from which life was rising, even more occasionally saw workers bending to reap a healthy crop. But generally the scene was just as Hairstone Banty had predicted. There would be many hours of dead land, she'd said, then they would travel through the steppes and over the three rivers to the province of Bem, of which Limby was the capital city. Gentle had doubted her competence at the time. She'd been smoking a weed too pungent to be simply pleasurable, and wearing something unseen elsewhere in the town, a smile. But dope fiend or no, she knew her geography. As they travelled, Gentle's thoughts turned once again to the origins of the power Pi had somehow awakened in him. If, as he suspected, the mischief had touched a hitherto passive portion of his mind and given him access to capabilities dormant in all human beings, why was it so damned reluctant to admit the fact? Hadn't Gentle proved in the mountains that he was more than willing to accept the notion of mind embracing mind? Or was that commingling now an embarrassment to the mischief, and its assault on the platform a way to re-establish a distance between them? If so, it had succeeded. They travelled half a day without exchanging a single word. In the heat of the afternoon, the train stopped at a small town and lingered there while the flock from Maike disembarked. No less than 4 suppliers of refreshments came through the train while it waited, one exclusively carrying pastries and candies, among which Gentle found a variation on the honey and seed cake that had almost kept him in Attaboy. He bought 3 slices, and then 2 cups of well-sweetened coffee from another merchant, the combination of which soon enlivened his torpid system. For its part, the mischief bought and ate dried fish, the smell of which drove Gentle even farther from its side. As the shout came announcing their imminent departure, Pi suddenly sprang up and darted to the door. The thought went through Gentle's head that the mischief intended to desert him, but it had spotted newspapers for sale on the platform and, having made a hurried purchase, clambered aboard again as the train began to move off. Then it sat down beside the remains of its fish dinner, and had no sooner unfolded the paper than it let out a low whistle.
"Gentle, you'd better look at this."
It passed the newspaper across the aisle. The banner headline was in a language Gentle neither understood nor even recognised, but that scarcely mattered. The photographs below were plain enough. Here was a gallows, with 6 bodies hanging from it, and, inset, the death portraits of the executed individuals. Among them, Hamarioc and Pontiff Pharaoh, the lawgivers at Vanayef. Below this rogue's gallery, a finely rendered etching of Tick Raw, the crazy evocator.
"So," Gentle said, "they got their comeuppance. It's the best news I've had in days."
"No, it's not," Pi replied.
"They tried to kill us, remember?"
Gentle said reasonably, determined not to be infuriated by Pi's contentiousness.
"If they got hanged, I'm not going to mourn them. What did they do, try and steal the Merotiti?"
"The Merotiti doesn't exist."
"That was a joke, Pi,"
Gentle said, deadpan.
"I missed the humour of it, I'm sorry," the mischief said, unsmiling. "Their crime."
It stopped and crossed the aisle to sit opposite Gentle, claiming